Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, we'll be joined by Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon, who will discuss the latest state plans connected with COVID-19.
You know, we might see a surge in the first part of May, and we certainly don't want to make that worse.
One economist says the closure of casinos on the Wind River Reservation could gut reservation economies.
We run a risk, essentially, of reversing what's been about 30 years of slow but at least steady progress.
And as small rural hospitals in Wyoming are preparing for a potential surge of patients, they are worried about their health care providers.
If you're surging and having, you know, very critical patients and many more patients in your beds than usual, your challenge is going to be having enough staff to take care of those patients.
Those stories and more are coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. We're going to start the program by speaking with Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon, who joins us on the telephone from Cheyenne. And Governor, first off, thank you so much for making time to visit with us.
Oh, it's always my pleasure, Bob.
Well, let's get right to it. Certainly lots to talk about surrounding COVID-19 and certainly our economy in the state. Governors, I know, had a chance to talk with the president. There's a lot of interest in maybe reopening the economy. Governor, you're hearing that on one side. You've got the other side that still wants even maybe more protections in our state. What are you anticipating doing here?
Well, Bob, it was nice to hear the governor, the president talking about his Open Up America Again program. And as we looked through it from the state, phase one, we've never really departed from. You know, it's about social distancing. It's about keeping groups less than 10. It's about practicing good hygiene. It's about not going to the store unless you absolutely have to, and then going in small groups and things like that. And as you know, over the last several weeks, there's been a tremendous amount of pressure to first lock down Wyoming and then now to open it back up. And we've pretty much stayed the course. I've just been on the phone with a number of businesses around the state. There's no doubt that there's a demand destruction and business has been suppressed, but people are still going to work and they're still working. So what we've done, Bob, is I've asked the Department of Health, and as you know, we have some task forces that work on business matters, to look at what the metrics should be in terms of testing, in terms of the amount of personal protection equipment, that PPE that people talk about, that need to be on hand. What are the things we're going to look at in terms of numbers of positives? What's the amount of community spread that we have? How many beds, how many ICUs, how many ventilators, and come up with a metric that we want to make sure the people of Wyoming understand, because we've been successful so far. The things we're doing have flattened the curve. We do expect that, you know, we might see a surge in the first part of May, and we certainly don't want to make that worse.
Done a lot of things. Obviously, we've shut down schools for now. We've closed the restaurants and the bars and coffee shops and gyms and those types of things. Do you anticipate that continuing for a little while?
I do. That's all absolutely coherent with phase one of Trump's plan. It's certainly the way we've been looking at it. And I think one of the things that's really interesting to me is if you look around Wyoming, there are some places, Teton County, Natrona County, Laramie County, that have higher incidences, certainly Fremont, and others where there really is a very minimal impact, Crook County, Bighorn County. Some of those counties don't really feel the effect. So it's been important to communicate with all of our surrounding states. So I've talked to Governor Polis, and I've talked to Governor Ricketts, and Governor Noem and Governor Bullock and Governor Little and Governor Herbert, just so that we, as people are getting ready for summer, we don't, in an unexpected way, you know, bring a lot of people from a place like Weld County, which is one of the hot spots in Colorado, into Wyoming and inadvertently introduce something when we're doing pretty well right now.
Governor Mark Gordon visiting with us. You know, you got some budget numbers here this week that were probably so bad that you just kind of go, well, I don't know what we're going to do about this one. You know, you've got a special session probably coming up from the legislature, if not three or four special sessions to try and address things. This has got to be a long-term process, doesn't it, to try and get ourselves out of this?
Yeah, Bob, I would say, you know, talking with our oil and gas operators, a lot of them are shutting down in the end of March, 27 rigs. Now we're down to 7 rigs and probably on our way down to zero. That demand isn't going to come back overnight. And so we really are, I think, in this for a bit of a long haul. We also know how many people are out of work right now. We've been really working hard at the state to make sure people can get the unemployment they need. We were able to get through the small business loans. We've gotten over $700 million out into small businesses, everybody from small fence contractors to larger manufacturing companies, to keep them going. But all of that is going to take a time to play out. And in fact, you know, you were talking about the most recent numbers that we're seeing out of the Consensus Revenue Estimating Group, the CREG, and those numbers are really a month delayed. So we started into this COVID crisis kind of the middle of March, and so our numbers, we don't think, reflect how bad it's going to be until really next month, when we'll probably call an emergency CREG meeting.
I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars. You're going to get, though, some federal money. How much will that actually help?
Well, the $1.25 billion that that is anticipated for every state minimum, that's going to be incredibly helpful, but it all has to be in some way either spent or committed by December 31st. So there's a little bit of a cliff coming next year, and I think the temptation to try to get that much money spent appropriately, that's going to be almost as challenging as not having money. Because we don't want to, you know, just throw it at things or waste it. It's got to be used in a way that is somehow tied to what happened with COVID, but can't replace revenue lost. So we're working at trying to make sure the State Loan and Investment Board can exercise judgment with the MRG program to help shore up hospitals, things with communication. I think with schools, it's going to be, we've seen some gaps. So schools have adapted incredibly well, and our university and community colleges have as well. But there's maybe some things we can do there to help stand them up, to get them ready for the fall, because we're still going to have the virus this fall. And so we'll be looking at a lot of things that are going to be different over the next several months.
We dropped a couple of stories today, Governor, to squeeze you in, and one of those would have actually dealt with sales tax for communities and the state. Is there help on the way for some of the communities who are, you know, I'll use Laramie as an example, who are really going to get hammered because of all the loss in sales tax revenue with students not coming back, that sort of thing?
Absolutely. That is one of the things that yesterday I met with the Management Council legislature, and I've been talking on a regular basis with leadership about what we can do to pivot a lot of the monies that are going to be coming to the state back out to the communities and counties to help them during this period of time. You know, one thing, Bob, I would say that has been really refreshing to me. Normally, there's a little bit of give and take between the legislative and executive branches, and we are all on board trying to figure out how to make this work. It's just been a great operating environment to work with legislative leadership and legislative service office. We're just all in this together.
And then unemployment dollars, you'll have enough to help people out, because there's going to be people who aren't going to get back to work for a while.
Yeah, Director Cooley, Robin Cooley, we had probably one of the strongest unemployment trust funds going into this. We continually model it. One of the things that I have been asking the legislature to help us with is a program called WorkShare. And what WorkShare allows is, if, let's say, you're working 40 hours a week, but your employer reduces your hours to 30 out of a need to reduce payroll but keep you on, can unemployment make up a little bit of the difference? So we're looking at that. That'll put a new tweak on that trust fund. But we do think our trust fund is whole, and we are really trying to model it on almost a daily basis to make sure that we don't get out ahead of ourselves.
Governor, we've got about a minute or so left here, but is it fair to say you've got a lot of people that are saying, hey, look at our numbers, with the exception of a few places, are doing great. You referenced that a second ago. But how dangerous is it really right now? Are we sort of teetering a little bit, because one little incident seems like it could really cause a lot of problems in the state? Is it really important to try and remind people that, yeah, this is still scary?
It is still scary, and it is important that people remember that we're teetering. We don't have enough personal protection equipment. We don't have enough testing supplies. The people of Wyoming have really stepped up. They've been socially distancing themselves. They've been doing the right things to keep our numbers pretty flat. So if we start to relax that, we could have the sort of thing that happened to JBS in Greeley or happened in Sioux Falls, where, 10% of the pork production went down in one day, 350 some odd cases of COVID. But, our employers are adapting. They're doing the right thing. They're making sure their workers are safe. And the people, this is where I've stood all along, as you know, is saying Wyoming people know that this is their responsibility not to create a problem. And I'm really counting on them to continue to do the right things. Our surge is expected to come the first part of May. And if we can avoid that, we'll be one step closer to getting through this.
Any more testing that you're aware of that could be coming our way?
We're working on all fronts, trying to get tests from Abbott, from Cepheid, from BioFire. We're doing everything we can to get those coming, and it's just a slow process.
Governor Gordon, thank you very much for the time, and we wish you well through all of this.
Well, thank you very much, Bob. It is important to remember that we're still in this, and we have the opportunity to keep it at bay. So we'll just keep working hard for that. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, Governor. When we come back, we'll take a look at how the closure of Wind River casinos could impact the reservation economy. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. As the COVID-19 pandemic keeps most people cooped up at home, ranchers are in a unique position to mostly continue with the status quo. In fact, it might even be a little bit better, as they have kids at home to help with the numerous spring chores. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim talks to two families who are navigating the balance of ranch and schoolwork.
It's a calm Wednesday afternoon, with snow falling down over a ranch in southern Wyoming. Normally, high school sophomore Kagan Sims would be sitting in English 11. But due to COVID-19, he's outdoors, feeding pregnant cows. Later in the day, on a call, he says he's figuring out a new balance between work and school.
I'll just take Mondays and get all my schoolwork for the week done. And then the rest of the week, not counting Sundays, I'll just be doing whatever these guys need me to do.
The Sims Ranch works with 650 head of cattle. Right now, they're getting ready for the busy season in the summer, where you have to move cattle daily, make hay, irrigate, move fences. And rather than COVID-19 slowing things down, it's actually allowing the Sims to get a jump start. Melinda, Kagan's mom, says that's thanks to having him and his sister Gentry around.
We're starting to calve our heifers right now, and Kagan's been able to take a night watch because he doesn't have to get up for school early the next morning. Gentry's been feeding a bum calf for us, and that just frees Shannon and I up to pay attention to our heifers a little more. It just makes it easier on all of us.
It might sound like Kagan and Gentry are getting a raw deal, but they're getting paid for their work. They also don't mind it. While feeding cattle later, Kagan says it's just like an early summer.
Call me what you want for saying this, but really, this has provided me with a lot of opportunities that I wouldn't have had otherwise. I've been able to be around my family more, and coming home and being on the ranch, it gives me a chance to do what I actually love to do.
Though he and his sister do miss seeing friends. His parents love having them around, but there are challenges. They want to make sure school is still the first priority. Gentry's already missed a class Zoom meeting due to helping move cattle.
I'm worried about, are the kids getting what they need? Are they getting the support from us that they need? Are we in their business too much? You know, because we're not used to being involved in their day-to-day schoolwork.
Ian McGivney is also home from school right now. He's studying agricultural production at a college in Cheyenne, but he's now back at his family's ranch in northern Wyoming.
It's hard to not be excited to come home, and especially this time of year, all them baby calves and baby lambs running around.
Between class, he's helping out at the ranch too, where they oversee 50 head of cattle and 50 sheep. His mom's happy he's there to help with a variety of tasks. Branding will be easier, for example. Like the Sims, it's also better to have additional help, just to watch out for calves being born. That came up just last night.
Well, we had to put a bum calf onto a cow that ended up losing her calf, but we got her all taken care of, and now the calf has a mom and the mom's got a baby, so everything worked out good.
His mom, Rose, says it's also nice because Ian's dad works out at a bentonite mine driving heavy equipment. This way, there's always someone home if a cow is giving birth or something needs to get done. For Rose, the only major change is reverting to old ways.
He's been in college for 3 years, so we're not used to having him home this time of year. And we want to boss him, and he's like, I'm 21, I don't need to be bossed.
For others, hiring is a big challenge. The McGivneys say it's likely helpful to welcome kids home, given hiring outsiders may be difficult right now due to the pandemic, but also because markets just aren't looking good enough for folks to afford it. Ian, for example, was expected to intern on someone else's ranch this summer, but can no longer do that. Other than that, the McGivneys and the Sims agree that not too much has changed due to the pandemic. In fact, they just feel bad for everyone else.
It's almost been nice because, I feel horrible for them people, that are living in these big cities that are trapped in their apartments and whatnot. But shoot, out here, checking cows and stuff, you almost forget that something's even going on.
Those in the ag world forecast a tough year for producers, with lower returns for their products. But for now, families are able to continue on at home with a little extra help. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
More than 500 tribal casinos are shut down due to the coronavirus pandemic, and that means many tribal governments have lost their primary source of revenue. Joseph Kalt, with Harvard University's Project on American Indian Economic Development, spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr this week. He said the pandemic could set back 30 years of economic progress brought forth by tribal gaming.
Well, there's been a major impact of this economic activity finally coming to the reservations. A tremendous increase in jobs, both for the Indians on the reservation as well as many non-Indians in the local communities. And the funds that come out of those casinos, as well as some other tribal businesses outside the gaming industry, those are the tax base for a tribal government. Tribes don't have the typical tax base that a state and local government does. They depend upon their gaming revenues and other business revenues to fund their governments. As a result of that, we've seen a massive expansion across the country in the ability of tribes to deliver the whole range of basic public services that we expect any city, county, or state to provide. And it's had a dramatic impact on the quality of people's lives.
So how do casino closures impact tribes like the Northern Arapaho Tribe here on Wind River that fund part of their government with gaming revenues?
Well, in the case of Wind River, they're going to be like many other tribes. They're facing, you shut the doors of that casino, and you're basically cutting off all your tax revenue. And so many tribes are now facing layoffs, not just of the casino employees, but in the various programs that the revenues from the gambling business supports. So we're having people get unemployed, both Indian and non-Indian, in large numbers across the country. Second, you're having to, in many cases, cut way back or shut down basic programs, ranging from health clinics to housing support to education programs. And then lastly, we're seeing tribes either having to dip into some assets, rainy day funds, if they've been able to build them up over the last many years, or tribes are going into debt to try to hang on to the employees and keep their pensions and keep the insurance and so forth. So it's a really drastic situation because there's just been this abrupt cutoff in the flow of funds.
But right now, tribal casinos aren't eligible for loans through the Federal Paycheck Protection Program. Is that right?
Yes. The rules that have been issued are, for reasons no one could quite understand in Indian country, tribal casinos, gaming operations are shut out of, for example, the Small Business Administration kind of funding.
So if federal aid isn't sufficient, and if some of these tribal gaming enterprises do fail, what are the long-term consequences of that?
Well, it varies from tribe to tribe, but almost all tribes have used substantial portions of their business earnings and plowed them back into rebuilding reservation towns, the schools, the libraries, the health clinics, the police departments, just about everything. And so the long-term concern is that we run a risk, essentially, of reversing what's been about 30 years of slow but at least steady progress in economic development and jobs creation and just the overall standard of living. So one big impact is that you go back to a time in which there's just no money, everything's falling apart, nobody's got a job, you know, the kind of place where the United States tribes were back in the 60s and early 70s. The other thing is the regional impacts. Many regions, Riverton, Wyoming, for example, depend a great deal on the money that's flowing in through that community because of the presence of the tribe, its government, its enterprises. And so we would really be worrying about places like that suffering a kind of long, drawn-out recession in their economies if and when this crisis persists over a long time.
So I sometimes hear from listeners who are sort of grumpy about tribal gaming. They don't think it's fair that tribes get to have these kinds of enterprises. And I wonder how you respond to that in a time like this.
Sure. And it is a common view, but it actually misunderstands the law of the United States. Actually, Wyoming, for example, has a special right to have gaming. The voters of Wyoming tomorrow could get it on the ballot and have gaming. Gaming rights are no more a special right for tribes than they are for the state of Wyoming, the state of Montana, the state of California, the state of Nevada. Having said that, with all this economic activity, tremendous amounts of economic development are leading to tremendous amounts of tax revenues for the various states. When we look in Wyoming, our modeling suggests that right now, Indian economic development, primarily the casinos, is generating on the order of about $12 million a year for the state of Wyoming and another $35 million in federal taxes. So the tribes are, in fact, generating tax revenues as those workers go out and spend. And the result of that is a benefit to the state of Wyoming.
That's Joseph Kalt, an economist with Harvard University's Project on American Indian Economic Development. When we come back, we'll look at how COVID-19 has impacted hospitals and other things in this state. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Nationally, New York, South Dakota, and many other states are experiencing an overwhelming number of COVID-19 patients. But Wyoming is not projected to reach its peak number of coronavirus cases until early May. So while small rural hospitals wait for an influx of those people, they are preparing to try to make sure they have all the resources they need to keep them alive. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska reports.
Most hospitals in Wyoming have been lucky enough not to experience a surge of COVID-19 cases yet and have been preparing for a while. Some models predict that surge to hit Wyoming in the beginning of May. The vice president of nursing at Star Valley Health, Tori Probst, says they have stopped providing all non-essential services in the hospital following the Centers for Disease Control's recommendation.
We tried to transition most of our outpatient clinics into telehealth, and we're even utilizing that from a urgent care standpoint as much as possible. And so we're still trying to meet the needs of the community.
Small rural hospitals need this time to prepare. They only have a handful of providers, beds, ventilators, and other resources. Probst says this waiting period lets them prepare for the potential influx.
So we've created two more negative pressure rooms within our ER. We originally had one, so now we have a total of three in our ER.
What that means is that they've created isolated patient rooms that keeps air from traveling outside of the room and possibly contaminating others. The biggest challenge for these smaller facilities in a pandemic is keeping their healthcare providers healthy so they can work. Hot Springs County Memorial Hospital CEO Margie Molitor says this is a big deal.
Our big challenge is going to be staffing because we usually have a census of five patients. So if you're surging and having, you know, very critical patients and many more patients in your beds than usual, your challenge is going to be having enough staff to take care of those patients.
Part of keeping staff healthy is making sure the hospital has enough personal protective equipment like masks and gloves. But the shortage of PPE is a national one. Everyone is scrambling to find them. Molitor says they are okay for now.
We have to have all the proper PPE, and we're training them how to use it, and having a spotter watch them put it on and take it off so that we can make sure that they are safe.
National Rural Hospital Association CEO Alan Morgan says making sure rural hospitals have enough PPE is especially important.
If you're in a small rural community and you've got a couple general practitioners, you cannot afford for them to go offline by becoming COVID-19 positive. I realize that access to protection gear is important for all locations, but there just is no room for error in a rural context.
Morgan says rural hospitals outside of Wyoming are already experiencing this.
These small rural hospitals, they only have 25 beds, and all of a sudden they're presented with 5, 10, 30, 40 patients in the door, where they have to not only use their traditional staff, they actually have to make sure that outpatient staff and staff that's not normally trained now can fill in.
Unfortunately, many people predict that this surge is not an if, but a when, because in general, rural demographics have a big percentage of those at risk of getting the coronavirus.
Older, sicker, poorer, much higher percentage of chronic health issues, larger percentage of obesity, hypertension, diabetes. Everything that I have just said are exactly that patient demographic most at risk for COVID-19.
Morgan says small Wyoming hospitals will be filled with the wrong type of patients to try to survive and mitigate this.
They're built for primary care. They're not built for pandemic surge issues.
What rural hospitals usually do is transfer patients to bigger hospitals that can handle more serious patients. This is what hospitals are doing now, but during a surge, there may not be a possibility to transfer. And if that happens, Star Valley Health's Tori Probst says,
I feel like the biggest is going to be staff and making sure that we have enough staff in order to care for these patients. We don't have a large pool to pull from, for lack of a better word.
And those staff may have to make some hard triage decisions, like who gets a ventilator or who doesn't. Hot Springs County Memorial CEO Margie Molitor says if residents follow the stay-at-home recommendations and other orders, this won't have to happen.
that will nip it in the bud right then and there, and then we don't have to worry about all the downstream problems because we don't socially isolate.
Governor Mark Gordon puts it more simply. We can stop Wyoming hospitals from getting overloaded by staying at home. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Staying with the topic of healthcare, in this time of COVID-19, relatively routine tasks and procedures have become a little more scary. And that includes something like childbirth. Typically, expected mothers would have had a lot of face-to-face interaction with their doctor, but times have changed. Wyoming Public Radio's Nina Rao has more.
Life has looked drastically different as COVID-19 hits every corner of the world. The coronavirus doesn't discriminate and can spread to pretty much anyone, including pregnant mothers like Vanessa Haney.
It did change the day-to-day for sure.
Vanessa was sailing along with regular appointments and checkups until the coronavirus came to Wyoming. She's 27 weeks along and is looking forward to her first child. Most pregnant women have the ability to social distance, and Vanessa works at home. And so you'd think she had nothing to worry about. But in her case, there's a challenge.
My husband's an emergency room doctor, so he is on the front line and coming home every night. And it took us a lot of, you know, thought as to how we were going to protect me.
So they decided to sleep separately. They have different entrances and exits.
And I cook him all the meals and everything so that he doesn't have to touch many surfaces.
Her appointments have also changed. For one, she is no longer going in for face-to-face checkups with her obstetrician in 2 months. And her husband is no longer part of the process.
I mean, he's been under a lot of stress with work. And then our physical distance, of course. But yeah, also he's not feeling any of the kicks. So it just, it is certainly creating sort of both a mental and physical barrier. He's a little disconnected more so than he would have been. So yeah, I do think he's missing out.
But she's still seeing her doctor, just through telehealth. While that is keeping her safe from coronavirus, she has some other worries.
During pregnancy, especially for first-time moms, which I am, you just have no idea. Like, am I the right size? Am I growing? Am I keeping my baby in nutrition?
Vanessa is due in July 2020, and she still plans on delivering her child in the hospital. And according to Dr. Samantha Harriet, that's still the best thing to do.
The recommendation is still to have a hospital delivery. We're not encouraging home deliveries. We still think it's safer to be in the hospital in a controlled environment.
Dr. Harriet is an obstetrician at Ivinson Memorial Hospital in Laramie. And she explains that the hospital has scaled down a lot of operations to ensure that it stays safe.
We have been working on plans for protection of our patients and our staff from the coronavirus for probably the last 2 months.
Like minimizing in-person visits and maximizing telehealth appointments.
We've changed a few other things. If we have a suspected patient who could have a respiratory illness, we're using negative pressure in the room.
Which keeps germs contained. Dr. Harriet says that many of the patients are also looking for ways to be safe, including how they time their delivery.
We've had several patients request induction of labor versus waiting for spontaneous labor, and that's really just an individualized decision.
For the most part, patients have been choosing a typical hospital delivery. Dr. Harriet said that they've taken additional steps to try and make sure that anyone who comes to the hospital is as safe as possible.
We're communicating with our medical providers in our community who maybe aren't working at Ivinson Memorial Hospital, but they're affiliated. So that way, the entire city of Laramie is on the same page as to how are we going to handle this.
Other things they're doing are taking temperatures of individuals who come in and using different entrances and exits to decrease contact. For expectant mother Vanessa, she's looking forward to the birth of her child and a world back to normal. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Nina Rao.
So many of the things we had all hoped to do this spring are canceled, and we grieve those things, big and small. But grief can fester, or it can air. Wyoming Public Radio producer Aaron Jones set up a voicemail for you to give air to your grief, and you answered with dozens of messages, replies, and voicemails. Here are some of those messages.
Hi, my name is Andrea Arbona. I live in Lander, Wyoming.
Hello, my name is Catherine Turner. I'm here in Jackson.
My mom is turning 90 on April 20th.
I had a 2-week trip planned. Years ago, my dad and I put a deposit down on a trip to raft the Grand Canyon together. And it's a trip he's been wanting to take his whole life. So now at 79, that was going to be his chance to finally see that very special part of the world. We've had to postpone. We're saying postpone because we still hope to have her birthday party. That trip is not going to happen because it was scheduled in May, even though we've been waiting for years and years for our chance. And now we will be lucky if we will get on a waiting list for 2023. But I won't be able to travel and be with her on her birthday like I've done every year since I can remember. And my dad will be 81 at the time. So I'm really disappointed because I just don't know if his health will. You know, it's a big trip. It's a high adventure class 13 whitewater trip, and I just don't know if 3 years from now he'll be up for that kind of a thing. So
we're both very distraught about it, but understand the need to cancel the trip.
Really heartbroken.
Hello, my name is Alejandro Alonso Galva. I go to the University of Wyoming MFA program. And my story is basically about my grandfather, who was actually the first person to die of the coronavirus in Costa Rica. He caught it from one of my aunts, who was asymptomatic. She caught it at the hospital because she's a nurse. And, you know, she came home one day and had dinner with my grandpa, gave it to him. And he eventually got sent to the hospital in the ambulance, intubated, all of that. And yeah, my whole family, from me here in Laramie to my mom in Omaha to family in Puerto Rico, Miami, New York, even other parts of Costa Rica, nobody could go see him. It was ironic because he had so many children, so many grandchildren, and this big family, nobody could be with him. His name was Dr. Roberto Galva. We call him Bebeto because I don't know if kids couldn't pronounce the word Roberto, so we'd say Bebeto.
I'm a transgender man here in Laramie, Wyoming, and because of coronavirus, I lost the ability to get gender affirmation surgery this year.
I'm very blessed. I'm a freshman in high school, so I'm not missing out on much. I come from a very economically stable family, so I don't really have to worry about where my next meal will come from. I think the main thing I've lost really is just a sense of security within my nation and economy, because I've seen how the coronavirus has ravaged other nations in this world, such as Italy, and kind of growing up a little faster and thinking about, wow, how the economy is going, and like in 5 years, how when I'm going to be an adult, and what am I going to do? And it's just, I don't know. I haven't really, so far it doesn't seem like I've lost a lot, but kind of a little bit of childhood innocence.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Be well.
Those are the voices of Wyoming residents reflecting on what they've lost due to the coronavirus pandemic. Aaron Jones produced the piece. When we come back, we'll look at how performers are dealing with social distancing. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. With most public spaces still closed across the state until at least April 30th, people in the performing arts are doing what they do best. That's getting creative. Wyoming Public Radio's Megan Feary has more on how the arts are adapting during the pandemic.
You know, Grandpa, he wore a suit to dinner almost every day.
That's John Seidel performing live on YouTube at the Jackson Hole Hootenanny last month. The Hootenanny, or The Hoot, is an acoustic musical showcase performed every Monday night at Dornan's, a local bar and restaurant just outside the entrance to Grand Teton National Park. And except for extreme weather, it's never been canceled. Then the pandemic happened.
And we had hoots, I think, through the end of February. And then, you know, we're starting to think about, good grief, is Dornan's still going to be open?
On March 19th, Dornan's closed, along with all other bars, theaters, nightclubs, and most other public spaces in Wyoming. For those in the performing arts who rely on a live audience, it was shocking. Ann Mason runs Relative Theatrics, a theater company in Laramie, and says the pandemic forced performers to get resourceful.
Theater artists were good at adapting and at creating new worlds under high pressure. I mean, that's what we do on a daily basis. It's what we're trained for.
So, like the Hootenanny, the theater company went online. Relative Theatrics began holding weekly virtual play readings. In Sheridan, WYO Performing Arts and Education launched Virtual Vaudeville, an online performance series that anyone can participate in. Executive Director Aaron Butler says it was important that they do something.
When crisis happens, you react with art. So you react with theater, you react with a place to bring people together and experience something together and have a conversation and maybe just be uplifted for a minute, but it's so strange that that's not even allowed.
And, Butler adds, it's really not that unique.
Even in, like, World War II, theater and art and these things still existed to just help get people through. So it's critical, in my opinion.
But it's hard without an audience. The Hootenanny has upwards of 25 musicians all performing from home. So while many are grateful to still perform, John Seidel says it's a big adjustment.
You start playing a few songs and nothing happens. I mean, is anybody out there? I don't know. The only feedback you get is looking at yourself on the screen and saying, well, let's see, am I too close? Am I too far away? Whatever.
Ann Mason of Relative Theatrics also finds the experience strange, but sees it as an opportunity for performers to hone their craft.
There's a lot of feedback that we get as performers from our audience members. When you hear them gasp or laugh, there's a reinforcement there that, like, okay, I'm doing a good job. You don't have that when it's virtual. So as the performer, you really have to trust yourself and the work that you have done because you're not going to be getting that real-time feedback.
But while live feedback can't happen, both Mason and Seidel found that live streams more than doubled their audience with viewers from all over.
We had an actor who was in LA, and then we had a playwright in Illinois, and we had former subscribers that have moved away from Laramie who got to reconnect with Relative Theatrics.
There's a fellow who's stuck in Thailand who has been watching us.
While performing might be strange for the artist, Ann Mason says it helps her.
I really believe in the arts. I believe so, so, so wholeheartedly in theater and the power of theater. I'm really falling back on that faith that I have in these moments where I get scared.
She adds that in times like these, art has worth.
The value of theater and the value of the art to make a space to be there for each other in a really difficult moment of time that is so anxiety-ridden. Hopefully, the theater can provide some relief and create a space where we can be safe.
But they all can't wait to get together in front of a live audience again sometime soon. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Megan Feary.
Thank you. Traditionally, spring is a time for transformation. Take college students, say a freshman who's now used to living away from home, or a senior getting ready to graduate and begin a new chapter in their life. But things look a lot different this year. Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen spoke with two college students about a changed reality and an experience cut short.
It's the Monday after spring break, a day when students and professors would usually be returning to campus. But that traditional springtime bustle is nowhere to be seen here at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. Instead, that's the sound of moving carts. Students and parents are using them to haul beanbags and microwaves out of the dorms and into their cars. On the sidewalk, there's a message written in brightly colored chalk. It says, "See you in the fall, go Pokes." One of those freshmen packing up her life is psychology student Luna Adelt.
I was living in the honors house for the whole first semester, and then up until spring break, when I moved back in with my parents in Laramie.
The honors house is basically a dorm for students in the honors program. Adelt says she lived there with about 30 other roommates.
I mean, we all heard a lot about bigger universities moving online and stuff like that, but I didn't really think that it would get to that point in Wyoming. So I was pretty surprised that they took such kind of drastic measures, but it does make sense now.
When Adelt returned to the honors house to collect her things, she says that's when it really hit home.
And then I just went there and it was like completely empty, and usually you hear people like talking or in the kitchen or something, but it was just like dead.
Adelt says she knows she's lucky since she easily moved back in with her parents and her siblings, but she says it feels like moving backwards.
It's really weird because I kind of like started that experience, like I had a whole semester, and then also this spring semester I started basically getting used to always being on campus and like learning things and meeting people and stuff like that. So now it's just kind of like I've gone back to high school almost because I'm like living with my parents again.
In the meantime, Adelt says she and the friend she made her first year at college are still trying to stay in touch.
We do just like text each other a lot and like send TikToks about the virus and like dumb things like that. But yeah, it's kind of hard to stay really connected.
Freshmen like Adelt aren't the only students trying to make sense of the change. For college seniors, it means no graduation. That was really disappointing for Alyssa Wessner.
That was the one thing that I was really looking forward to at the end of the 4 years of struggle that I've gone through here on campus.
Wessner spent the last 4 years working to complete her degree while holding down a full-time job. She's a non-traditional student at 32 years old, and she says it hasn't been easy.
Spent many, many long hours, a lot of my own money, time, energy on finally completing something. Just not being able to have that transition from all of the work that I've done over the past 4 years. It's a weird loss that I didn't ever think I'd have to be mourning.
Wessner has been studying environment and natural resources, as well as environmental system science. She says not being able to mark the end of her degree with a traditional ceremony and celebration feels like a huge letdown.
I just feel like while I'm completing all of this training and this learning and this whole process, it's just going to end up quietly disappearing into the universe, and I'm just going to have to move on without any closure.
Wessner will be refunded for her cap and gown purchase. As for freshman Luna Adelt,
they are going to try to give out refunds for the housing and the meal plans that are basically just are not going to be used now.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear it again, you can find it at wyomingpublicmedia.org. All you have to do is click on Open Spaces. You can also check out individual segments there or on Facebook. Anna Rader is our web editor. You'll never miss our show if you get our podcast. Also, we'd like you to consider to make a contribution in support of Open Spaces and our Wyoming news coverage. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.